You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yeah, and you know what? Here's the interesting thing. As I was telling you just a few minutes ago with Brooks Takanaka, we all gravitate over what happens in that big, beautiful building during the few days. And as you know, here comes Christmas. It's literally, depending on what day you're listening to this, either tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. And just to ensure that you have that fish on your table, and we know how frantic you are out trying to get it, just imagine what it takes to do this. I mean, we talk about area closures, quotas. We talk about supply and demand. At this time of the year, big demand. Not that much supply, or it, you know, it's supposed to be in the middle. And all of that is to do with a group of people to get together. It's a large group of people, just finished meeting. And Eric King is the PhD. He's the International Fisheries and Pelagic Enforcement guy for the council. And we played host. I would say we played host. But we actually had a meeting here just at the same time, and it was all about tuna. And it's a tuna commission. And I knew we were going to talk about this, Eric, but I had no idea how many players there were. And I don't think this audience really knows, when we talk about these meetings, who are the attendees and what sort of group. This is a big group, 500 people.
Yeah, so December 9th through the 14th was the 15th annual meeting of the Western Central Pacific Fisheries Commission, held here in Honolulu at the Convention Center. 27 countries, 7 participating territories, and about 8 cooperating non-members. So essentially 40 countries and territories, over 500 delegates, and then a whole swath or group of non-government organizations, every NGO you can think of.
And in many respects, Eric, these people are tasked to come forward with agreements, to meet things out, to measure things out, and to dole things out.
Yeah, it's essentially the commission stems from a treaty that all these countries signed.
Right.
So it's international convention that was signed actually here in Honolulu in 2000.
Okay.
So there's a long history of Hawaii being involved in this commission, and even the council. The council hosted all of the pre-meetings that led to the establishment of this convention in 2000. And the commission really has been operating since 2004. So we're, 15 years in of this commission. And its charge, essentially, is to manage the world's largest tuna fishery.
Which is us. But the interesting thing to me is that prior to that, there were rogue nations and rogue fishermen. And there still are. But, from what I understand, and you can put on your enforcement hat, once all of these agreements come to pass, the players that agreed to them, if they break the rules, there's consequences.
Yeah, that's the ultimate goal, is to have a strong compliance regime where if a country doesn't report its catches or it bypasses its obligations, that there would be sanctions on those countries, because everyone has agreed to play by the rules. And if they don't play by the rules, then they should be sanctioned. So currently there isn't a strong compliance regime with respect to sanctions. There is quite a lengthy process to understand and document whether or not a country meets its obligations or not. This commission hasn't gone as far as, if a country goes over its quota or doesn't report, if it doesn't implement these measures, then it actually gets less quota or sanctions. We're not there yet.
Yeah,
we need to get there.
Yeah, but one thing I want to make sure people understand, there's a big difference between that and fishing in the wrong place. What you're talking about in a lot of these cases is the quota is determined by, stock assessments and science to what we can and can't take out of certain areas. And if you abuse that, you've actually lightened your area's ability to serve itself. And aren't a lot of these countries and a lot of these people, Eric, a little bit different from us? We have a wider group of things that we eat. These people, maybe they count on this fishery. They count on that tuna.
Yeah, we count on it too. Big Eye, for example, is Hawaii Longline's biggest target catch. It's responsible for 60% of the total catch, $60 million. So really, the Hawaii Longline fishery is now primarily focused on Big Eye tuna. In the early years, it was doing a lot of swordfish, more yellowfin, but really it's about Big Eye. And, in the early 90s is when the first signal of Big Eye overfishing started to occur. And it's really because of the ramp up of the purse seine industry in the Equatorial Pacific fishing on fads.
Was that because of the ability to catch a lot more fish than they used to based on technology and science?
Yeah. So in the late 80s, early 90s, really the Western and Central Pacific purse seine fishery took off. U.S. vessels moved out of the EPO because of dolphin safe issues, moved into the West, and really found that there's a huge resource there, and really started fishing. It started on logs. Logs off of Papua New Guinea, floating down the rivers.
Yeah, by the way, you got to explain that. You know, when we're fishing out there trolling, when we find a log, a rubbish, a tree, a bucket, whatever, that's a fish. You know, and what you're talking about with these things is these aren't little tiny logs.
No, these are big, giant,
big logs.
Huge trees that you know, floated into the ocean. And really, the discovery was that there's a lot of fish under these logs, and that they could be harvested on industrial scales. You know, certainly there was large, you know, surface schools of aku and stuff like that, but the ability to also use a fish aggregation device, a FAD, so a floating raft, is replicating the effects of what a log does.
It's creating a food chain, right?
Right, it creates a little food chain. Yeah. And now, you know, each one of these FADs is equipped with an echo sounder, GPS satellite beacon. And so you have a company that deploys, you know, 300 to 400 of these FADs a year. And they're able to dial them up on a screen, even remotely, and know how much fish is under.
See, this is the part that blows me away. Mm-hmm. They can remotely dial up because of technology. They can say, look at R number 3. And somebody can say, okay, R number 3 is loaded. Let's go. We're a day away. Let's go catch those fish.
Yeah, and it's it totally revolutionized the fishery. Still about to this day, 40% of the catch is on FADs. The rest is what we call free school. But certainly the catch per unit effort, the efficiency on FADs is much greater than
what are the rules?
Searching for fish.
What are the rules on how many FADs somebody can deploy?
There's a just recently there was a limit on a number of FADs that can be deployed, 350, but that's sort of arbitrary. It doesn't really affect these guys' operation. Some group of countries in the Pacific are trying to get the commission to be able to track these FADs, so the actual international commission to have more of an ability to understand where these things go. And the guy in the countries themselves are working to track FADs in their waters for scientific and management purposes. But it has been a total game changer and really responsible for why the Western and Central Pacific is the world's largest tuna fishery.
I know that there are some of these things that are derelict, and some of them, you know, lose their ability to transmit and all of that kind of stuff. Is there anybody that can approximate? I mean, we look at the big garbage patch that everybody's worried about. Wouldn't there be like thousands and thousands of these things out there?
Yeah. So every year, about 60,000 of these FADs are deployed.
Oh, no, I can't stand that. That's a lot.
And about 60,000. About 25% are lost.
Yeah.
So either they keep floating around the ocean or they wash up on someone's reef or beach.
Yeah. Now, by the way, they're not killing. They're growing. In other words, even if I've lost my FAD, the FAD still works. You know, I mean, it still has a food chain because that's organic. I mean, I didn't do that. I just put the thing there and then the food grew on it.
Yeah. So with so much FADs now there's a sort of line of thought that it could be reducing the catch per unit or the yield per sand fisheries because you're spreading out the population and so many FADs are competing with one another. You know what I mean?
So.
So you could have less aggregations and that's a management issue. So currently, you know, over 1.5 million metric tons of aku are caught in this fishery.
That's
unbelievable. And, you know, the incidental catch of juvenile big eye and yellowfin is really the problem on these FADs. So about, you know, 70 to 80,000 tons of juvenile big eye catch are caught on purse seines with FADs. And then, you know, the purse seiners are also targeting adult free swimming schools of yellowfin at the surface, but also the use of FADs, they catch quite a number of juvenile yellowfin. And now yellowfin is showing some signs of concern as well. So
okay, now here's the thing that you need to get straight with everybody, and that is when Eric is talking, he's not talking about our longline fleet in Hawaii. We're talking about the big picture, and these purse seiners, the customer or the end user of the fish is totally different from ours.
Yep, it's canned tuna.
It's sticking in a can. Mm-hmm. And there are some that saying, well, if that's what you don't, why don't you just grow that, you know, Why don't you aquaculture that somewhere? That level of it. Why don't you let this better tasting, you know, loaded fish that deteriorates by canning it instead of appreciates, right?
Yeah. So the amount of yield you get by putting big eye in a can is much lower than if you caught it in a longline fishery.
Sure.
So once the big eye or yellowfin grows up to adult size, there's much more value in it in a different, you know, market, sashimi market or you know, fillet type of retail market, rather than putting it in a can. And big eye in a can is not good. It's not not a really a good product. It turns the can kind of, or the product kind of green.
And the thing that's happening there is that this is a piece of fish that could have you know, could have bought $5 a bite instead of $5 for three cans. So I mean, you know, right. but interestingly enough, and I know that you've been asked this question, when you open a can of tuna, you can see that, okay, how does that get in there? In other words, they cut the thing into fillets, and they have this stamp that puts a registered an amount of tuna in there. Mm-hmm. And then it gets the water or the oil or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And then it goes, and then it gets sealed, and then it gets cooked.
Yeah, actually, it gets cooked first.
Oh, that's what I mean. Yeah,
so it's frozen. You know, this is all frozen tuna that is, you know, offloaded at a cannery. American Samoa has got one of the biggest canneries in the world. Part of our jurisdiction at the council. And so these large purse seiners, you know, loft load their catch at the cannery. It gets cooked, and then it gets deboned.
Yeah.
And the way it gets deboned is by humans.
Magic.
Well, it's
labor.
It's a line of about 2,000 employees picking the bones out.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gets cooked again.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gets, you know, put into a can and water and oil.
And every time you say that, it makes me angry, because I'm like, want to take a slice out of that thing right off the hook and put it with the wasabi and the shoyu and have sashimi, you know?
Yeah. No, it's, you know, this is industrial fishing, and, you know, and there's positives to it. It provides jobs and, you know, benefits to American Samoa. It also feeds the world. I mean, canned tuna is a staple throughout the world. And the United States, you know, the primary market for canned tuna is albacore, much aku.
And we actually, Eric, and by the way, Eric Kingma with the Council is the International Fisheries Pelagic Enforcement and NEPA coordinator. We'll tell you about that in a minute, too. But taking a look at this big picture is important, because it's also, you have to look at, it's affordable. What we're looking at when we have our sashimi-grade big eye, you know, we're paying top dollar for a fish that's been really virtually massaged to the table. Mm-hmm. And what you're doing with this wonderful resource of tuna is that before we completely put these people down, whether they be skipjack or big eye or yellowfin or whatever, it's a matter of economy. The people that are eating that, they can't afford sashimi fish. They have to buy a canned fish.
Yeah, certainly. You know, it provides a healthy food product for over a billion people on the planet.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So it is amazing. And, you know, also if we're here locally, you know, a lot of local families rely on canned tuna. We eat it at our house. We eat more of the albacore because I think it tastes better. So when you go to the store and you see white chunk, or white meat albacore, white meat canned tuna versus light chunk. So white is albacore only.
Right.
The light
could be skipjack.
Light is aku and yellowfin mixed in with big eye. So there's two different products there. And you can get it in water, oil, stuff like that. But also here, you know, everyone loves poke. Everyone loves sashimi. You're going into the new year season where prices increase. Last week's meeting, the meeting that was held here, the Tuna Commission meeting, one of the focus was the United States, on the request of the council, submitted a proposal to increase our quota, the Hawaii longline quota.
Yeah, now, before you give it the bad news, let's make sure people understand why this even happened. We get to a point where if science would support what we're trying to do, sustainability, is that we just wanted to be able to avoid running out of quota, running out of our ability to catch fish before the demand runs out.
Right.
And so what happened?
Yeah, so really we entered into a new regime here with Big Eye. For the past 15 years or so, we thought Big Eye was in worse shape than it was. And that's, as I mentioned before, a mix of purse seine fishing on fads and longliners catching the adults. And, you know, I'm talking about China, Japan, Korea. Those mix of impacts led to big eye stock condition, which we thought was an overfishing. The best available science came out, new stock assessment came out last year that said, hold on, big eye is actually not in that bad a shape, and it's actually could increase yields and catches off the stock. And going into this meeting, the United States recognizing that the Hawaii fishery relies on big eye has an arbitrarily low quota for big eye compared to Japan. Japan's quota is 18,000 metric tons. Our quota is 3,500 metric tons.
Which is a huge difference.
You know, China's is around 9,000.
Even withstanding the huge populations that we're talking about, it's still not right.
Right. So, so Japan has a huge quota, Korea has a huge quota, and the United States has a very small quota. Mm. So recognizing that big eye stock is a much better condition, we could support increased catches. The United States submitted a proposal to increase our quota in a very small amount, only by 1,000 metric tons. Mm-hmm. And it did so on the premise that we have a much higher observer coverage in our fleet. The the minimum standard is 5%. Ours is around 25%. Yeah. And very few of those countries are even making that 5%.
Yeah.
Secondly, we don't transship any of our catch on the sea, and the high seas.
And
whereas all these other countries are transshipping big eye. And it's mostly that minus 60 ultra low temperature big eye. Mm-hmm. To carrier vessels that take it to Japan, to China, and very low monitoring on it. So we went in and said, Hawaii fishery is distinguished from these other fleets. Every pound can be found, as my colleague Dalzell used to say.
I love that. Paul, the senior scientist, you know, if he leaves anything with me, it's a couple of his little slogans. They're great.
He's a brilliant guy. And he's also finished two novels recently. Yeah. But so we went in and... When we went to the negotiation in Honolulu, it was we didn't get much support from any other countries.
Yeah.
Now, why was that? I think it's because the United States didn't do any legwork beforehand. They sent a couple guys from D.C. to negotiate on our behalf, and they didn't do much work beforehand. Yeah. They didn't get the coalition of nations to provide support. But throughout the negotiation, there was a couple windows to get something, and... we didn't get it. The United States government did not get that support from other countries because you have to get support. You have to have consensus on allocations within the tuna committee.
You know, gang, this is one of the reasons why we wanted to do this. I already knew, based on my multi-year relationship with the council, and as you know, they are a very important sponsor of us to the program, that a lot of this is headier and goes over our head. The real bottom line here is that when you need to get a quota or something changed, and you have evidence that support it, you need people that are the leaders and the movers and shakers to get behind it. We often say this, that every now and again, you know, somebody in office or somebody making a decision, they believe the last something that they wrote or the last something that they read. We actually were, I don't know about, you know, you're not speaking for the council, you're speaking for yourself, and I'm speaking for myself. I was kind of disappointed. I thought that the case had been presented, that it would that the increase that you were looking for was not, you know, so overbearingly horrific. So what, you know, where did we get let down? What happened?
I think essentially the United States was negotiating against itself.
Yeah.
So,
yikes, I don't like
so
that.
So United States also has a large purse seine industry, about 35 vessels that fish on
not
the high
in
seas.
Our fishery, by the way.
No, they don't fish in Hawaii. They fish in the equatorial Pacific on the high seas. They also don't fish in any part of the American Samoa or Guam. And they fish in the EEZs, the zones of Pacific Island countries and the high seas. And they wanted something, and we wanted something. And actually, both of us didn't get what we wanted. Yeah. And so... why the council was advocating for higher quota is really about Hawaii consumers. It's about the industry. We don't want to be in a situation, which we have done in the past with our arbitrarily low quota, where we shut down our fishery at this time of year. You were talking about supply and demand. When the supply goes down at the most important market time of the year, that's a big problem. Hawaii consumers will be paying $60 a pound for ahi.
Yeah, and you know,
instead of $25.
And what we're talking about is right now, this minute. That's why it was important. It was just lucky that this meeting coincided with the holiday season, so that you would understand the real impact it does. Somebody else asked me to ask you. Also, way more popular now than before, and this is nationwide and worldwide, this whole thing about fish in a bowl, this whole thing that we went through, the poke bowl this and poke bowl that, it's created a huge demand for our fish, for the freshest and best quality fish. Why is that?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's a new type of experience for...
It's certainly a fad,
but
I love it.
And it's fat. You know, it's a fast meal. Yeah, you know, you can prepare it in a couple minutes, and it's healthy. And I think millennials love it.
Yeah.
So
I love it. I'm an old goat. I actually always, when I was a kid, most of our meals were in a bowl.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you didn't get a plate. You got a bowl. First, you put your rice, and then you put your vegetables and your protein, and there's your food.
Yeah, and it's taken off, and you'll walk down every city across America. There's a poke restaurant.
Yeah, a lot of them are calling, come over here and buy a poke bowl. but I think that this has had an inadvertent effect. Maybe it's even called attention to the fact that, hey, this is a real desirable, a healthy way to live, and it is.
Yeah, and we know the Hawaii fish landed is the best quality. Yeah. It's handled the best. And so, you know, the demand for that product is increasing. We also know that a lot of these restaurants are relying on, you know, frozen gas tuna that the average consumer in Nebraska has no idea.
No clue. You know. That's what we call the tailpipe tuna, my friends. Yeah. But interestingly enough, and let's follow up on this a little bit more. So the case was presented, and the opportunity to have it looked at was presented, and it didn't go our way. Does that mean?
So what we're stuck with now is we have a sort of status quo measure. We have a continued quota of around 3,500 metric tons, which is about 20% lower than where we started in 2009. We do have recognition of the territory arrangements. So our fishery, since 2011, has been fishing under agreements with the U.S. territories.
Right.
And we put that in place recognizing we had a very low quota, we have a high local demand market here, and we needed more fish. And so we created rules consistent with the Tuna Commission's measures to allow the Hawaii longline vessels to fish under quota agreements with the U.S. territories.
And friends, we've talked about this before with Eric and with others. And this is basically means that the geographical location is paid somehow for allowing somebody else to take their fish. And it doesn't necessarily go into their longline fishery or the same species fishery, but it sure has perked up a lot of other things like ice plants and boat ramps and small boats to fish inside that these territories or countries wouldn't have the ability to do.
That's right. So the U.S. territories, unlike other territories of Pacific Island countries, only have a relationship with the United States. So their funding opportunities come from the Department of Interior, a few grants here and there, whereas other countries are getting infused millions of dollars of capital funding from China, from Taiwan, from Japan. So our industry agreements with our U.S. territories is a important opportunity for our territories to get funds for fisheries development.
Yeah. But there's one thing that I don't know. If you're a fisherman, you already know this, but maybe Eric can explain it. If you're fishing, you know, a two-day trip out of Oahu on your longline boat, that fish is really fresh. You're going out there, you're catching that fish, you're taking great care of it, you're bringing it quick. Sometimes these other fish that you get to go catch are much more effort is needed, much more time is needed. And so you can't expect to have maybe the same quality or the same quantity if you're fishing far away, right?
Yeah, I mean, the tuna resources are dynamic. They're not uniformly distributed in the Pacific. Yeah. You know, there is preferred habitat for tunas, you know, based on their prey distribution, the salinity of the water, the oxygen content. And that changes throughout the year, years.
You've actually said this before. The fish has no idea what group it's, what piece of geography it's in.
Right.
It's just following that stuff they're eating.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, here in Hawaii, we are blessed to be in the Central Pacific, and our vessels have the ability to follow the fish. We're not surrounded by exclusive economic zones of other countries, so we can go find the fish around us, whereas other countries, their fisheries are more limited to a sense of where their countries are located and their neighbors. So Hawaii is well positioned into the future to continue to have a strong fishing industry. It's the number one food product produced in the United in Hawaii.
We've seen this just the other day. We talked about that a little bit last week with Sylvia Spaulding from the council. We talked about this wonderful resource that we have, and that it's seemingly like, do we really understand how valuable this is? Do we really get it?
You know, I think we take it for granted. Because if the fishery went away tomorrow, you know, that's a $100 million loss, mm-hmm. and that's wholesale value. If you translate that into jobs yeah. and the retail value, you're looking at several $100 million, close to $800 million.
Well, but by the way, when we say this, it's not with tongue in cheek. It's actually was statistically shown. It's number one in Hawaii. The macadamia nuts are far back second place.
That's right.
And you would have thought that would be the other way around. Macadamia nuts, we ship them all over right. the world.
Sugar, pineapple, all that's gone way down. Yeah. So it's really fisheries. And so when we talk about food security, you know, fisheries in Hawaii are incredibly important. And it's not just the longline fishery, although that provides a lot of fish, but it's also the troll guys, yeah. the bottom fish guys, even the spearfish guys. And it's all feeding Hawaii families and also our tourism economy. So, you know, our audience here recognizes the importance of fisheries, but others may not. And so we're going into you know, a new year. We need to advocate for our fisheries yeah. and maintain a strong, healthy fishing industry.
Okay, so that being said, we are disappointed at the results of this application, if you will, or this, you know. But what's next? I mean, you know, we're not going to just stick our tail between our legs and give up.
No, so we're going to live with this for the next couple of years. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, the council, we're developing a strategy for international engagement mm-hmm. and to work, you know, between now and when the negotiation ramps up again in 2020.
Yeah.
To work with international partners, you know, other members of the commission that are like-minded, that have industries like ours, and really align ourselves and get more support, because we can't rely on Washington, D.C. to do our negotiating for us or a sense, you know, support us throughout yeah. the year. So we need to develop relationships and agreements way early in advance of these December Tuna Commission meetings. And that's what my role at the council is going to be the next year or so, is to really develop a strategy yeah. to improve our quota
situation. Yeah, and herein lies the reason why we wanted to broadcast this and get you all aware of it. Because like I said earlier, you can do all of the homework you want to. You can statistically, you know, categorize stuff, and you can collect data, and you really make a case for the safety and the size of the supply and all of that stuff. But then you got to give it to somebody that you trust is going to take you across the ocean and, you know, several thousand more miles to get our government to reach out and help Hawaii out or help this fishery out.
And that's, you know, part of the problem too is you have other countries and they don't like to give in to the United States.
No, of course,
you know?
The big bad United States.
Big bad United yeah. States. So, yeah. But they all recognize Hawaii. Mm-hmm. They know us. We know them. They recognize how important, you know, Big Eye is to us and our fisheries are to Hawaii. And so when we talk to them one-on-one, it's like, we support you guys. Yeah. But then when you have, say, a United States bureaucrat or a Fed, yeah. it's a totally different yeah. face. Yeah. You know what I mean? So that's something that we need to work on. And you know, they do support. Even Japan supports Hawaii. Pacific Island countries support yeah. Hawaii. So it's just changing that narrative a bit with them.
And the other side of it is, and when Eric was talking about this before, and enforcement is the key in many respects, every time that there is one of these situations where somebody is blatantly not following the rules, it makes you, if you're sitting here in Hawaii and you can't even go and catch the fish that you feel you're entitled to get, it must be somewhat very frustrating sometimes to say, hey, wait a minute, this isn't right. We have to make sure that these people are toeing the line.
Yeah. You talk to some guy, you know, guys in the Hawaii longline industry, even the U.S. purse seiners, fishing side by side foreign fleets.
Yeah.
You know, we're getting high, there's an observer on our boat. And these other countries are just doing things that are really appalling sometimes.
Well, you know, one thing that is, I don't think that people understand is a problem, is the transferal of fish. I mean, you got some of these boats that they can't stay out for very long. But what they're going to do is they're going to take the fish from them. They're going to give them more fuel. They're going to, in other words, they're not going home. They're just staying
out
there.
So when we talk about longline fisheries, we're almost unique in the commission area in the Western Central Pacific, entire the Pacific. Our fisheries are completely ice chilled. So yeah. The longest Hawaii vessels are going out, longline vessels are 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So you have, in comparison, you have fleets of distant water fishing nations like China, Japan, Korea, Taiwan. You know, they have vessels that are 150 feet long that have a hold capacity of 100 tons and are able to fish continuously for a year.
Yeah.
So they...
Completely. What? Yeah, a year?
Yeah, a year. Yeah. So imagine that. Imagine signing up for a crew job or an observer job. Hey, I'm going out for a year. Yeah. See you later, family. But it's really tough. So, and those vessels are transshipping on the high seas, and it's mostly they're dealing with that ultra low temperature, that minus 60 degrees Celsius fish, which is really taking over the Japan market as well.
Very, very interesting. And you know, you can always go to WPCouncil.org and get filled in on this. What have you written, or what's going to be in the next newsletter that will deal with what happened at the meeting?
Yeah, we'll summarize it. We're going to summarize it in Hawaii Fishing News as well, an article coming out. And then, you know, longer term, we're working on that strategy to really distinguish Hawaii and to get the quota that it deserves and it needs.
Yeah, if you'll take a look at the January edition of Hawaii Boats and Yachts, my column, The Buck Stops Here, does deal a little bit with the new lunar calendar, with some of the other things that the council is doing. And we looked a little bit at the previous month, as you note, about the value of the catch. So I too will be making you guys, particularly you trollers, get behind this, because I've seen in the last year, and I want your opinion on this too, Eric, because of what you do, is I've seen a lot more good relationships developing between the in-water guys and the out-water guys, that the longliners are not taking away, you know, the guys from Molokai, the guy from Kauai's fish.
Yeah, I mean, the longline fleet really is fishing hundreds of miles away from Hawaii. They're not fishing right offshore Waianae anymore. That was the 80s.
That was a perception. That was a long time
ago. A long, long time ago. So these guys are fishing at the bare minimum 75 miles out, and that's very, very, you know, 3% of the effort. So most of the effort is 500 miles from Honolulu, and the amount of yellowfin, the ahi that really the trollers are going for, the impact from the Hawaii longline fishery is negligible.
Yeah, let's make sure that we underline that, particularly right now, because this, in the next day or two, people are going to be, you know, reaching into their wallets and paying some pretty nice, you know, money for this fish. When we first started doing this, and I think when I first met you and certainly other Dr. Dalzell and many of the others, we didn't really appreciate how much of a local ahi population there was. Right. In other words, didn't a lot of people think that the yellowfin cruised with the big eye and that they were visitors?
Yeah, so the scientific information that has been derived from tagging studies, from other life history sampling programs, suggests that we have a local yellowfin stock here.
Yeah.
You know, so they're born here and they stay here.
Yeah, and isn't there also something to suggest that there also might be some big eye that either adopt other places closer than there that were previously we thought they
Yeah, we don't think that all the big eye that are landed in Hawaii is certainly that, you know, that come to Hawaii this time of year that handline guys catch off fads. We don't think those are born in the equatorial Pacific, you know, 2,000 miles from here. We think there's a spawning aggregation maybe a little bit south of the Hawaiian Islands that is different than the fish that are really being hammered by the purse seine fisheries
and
along the equator.
Which gives me a little hope or a little faith that sooner or later science and the ability to talk to the leaders will get to a point where we can say, look, this is the assessment. This is the stock. We can verify this pretty good. And this is what we're getting. And it's just not right. Give us some help.
So right now, you know, big eye, yellowfin are managed from, say, Hawaii all the way to Indonesia.
Wow.
Or Hawaii to Ecuador in two different RFMOs, two different tuna commissions. We recently poised the question to the Pacific Islands Fisheries Science Center, where do Hawaii big eye come from?
Yeah.
And they don't know.
So what do they answer?
They don't know. So we're saying, well, go find out because, you know, it could have management implications. And so we've been advocating that they really step up their pelagic research ability, and they have been slow to date. So colleagues within the council and are relying on our science committee, we developed a whole pelagics research plan, and that's our number one priority, is to identify really where do Hawaii Big Eye come from. And also, it lends into the larger question about Big Eye stock structure, which to this day, there's a lot of unknowns about.
So what we got to do is we got to step up and reload and go after a higher quota.
We're not going anywhere. We're in it for the long run.
Thank you, Eric. Have a happy Christmas and a happy new year. See you again real soon, my friend. Eric Kingma. And if you want to know more about what we do here on the program, it is so simply easy. Go to WPCouncil.org. If you want to hear something on the program, or if you want to hear something from the council, you let me know. TheMikeBuckShow@gmail.com. Have a great, great, and I mean really great Christmas, and a haole makahiki. Eat plenty of fresh fish and realize somebody went out and caught that fish for you. Till next time, see ya.